Future Commerce is sponsored by Bolt. How can you boost e-commerce sales and conversions? Well, it's easy with Bolt's fast and secure one-click checkout. No usernames, no passwords, no problem. Just more happy customers and up to 47% more conversions. Learn more today at bolt.com/futurecommerce. This Future Commerce podcast is supported by Divvy, the free corporate card and expense management platform that combines seamless software and a smart Visa business card. Try it for free today at getdivvy.com/futurecommerce. That's getdivvy, DIVVY.com/futurecommerce. Future Commerce is brought to you by 3Kit. 3Kit is the visual commerce platform that accelerates growth by enabling customers to show their configurable products online. 3Kit, show more, sell more. Visit 3Kit online today at 3Kit.com/podcast. Sing it, Brian. Tearstream. Sing it. Down your face. Sing it. Come on. You can sing it.
Down your face.
He goes down the octave. I love it. Welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about crying CEOs and a bunch of other stuff. I'm Philip.
I guess that is in the falsetto.
Are you recording on your end, by the way?
I think I am.
You think you're recording on your Zoom device?
Yep, I'm recording.
Yeah, okay, good.
I'm live at Etel East, everyone.
All right, we're gonna cover a bunch of stuff here today. We're gonna talk about the cringe post of the decade, Braden Wallachy from Hypersocial. We're gonna talk about that. I think that this guy did nothing wrong. The algorithm made him do it. We'll get into that. Brian, you're at Etel East. Give me a little bit of a little overview. What's the mood like as we kind of head into the fall and the BFCM season?
It felt like business as usual, actually. It felt like everyone was fully back. It didn't even feel weird. Just felt like I think everyone just was like back to conference season. Like,
and
Etel East is typically a little smaller.
What I was going to say. Etel East, so if it's back to normal, it means Etel East was a little contained.
Yep.
Not very rowdy.
It felt really normal. Like, it felt like a normal Etel East, smaller than Etel West, maybe like, and like not in a critical way, like not as much fun as Etel West, because yes, Etel West is in Palm Springs. Although, and it was cloyingly hot in Boston.
Cloyingly hot.
Yes. the weather today is fantastic. And as usual, there was lots of good food to be had around Boston. I love going to Boston. Even in the heat, I was happy to be here. It's such a beautiful, beautiful city. That is such something that the Etel series has nailed. Is picking awesome spots to be.
Boston. It's a pretty dope little city. You're there right now, actually, as we're recording.
I am.
Yeah. So we've got this is the last big conference of the season, right? This sort of caps off the end of the sort of e-commerce. Everyone's getting back to work in building up towards the holiday season.
Unless we know that grocery shop. Which that's the
I guess you're right. No, that's in October, right?
September.
Okay, so we've got one more left here, but you know, I think grocery is probably less impacted in the same way that, you know, holiday purchasing patterns go. And also, what I've seen, we were at grocery shop last year. Remember that? That was like, I remember we had a really interesting podcast and talked about a lot of really. You know, sort of like, I think that was the first Vegas show back for us after COVID.
And but what I remember, recall, go ahead.
I was going to say the tone of the like vendor area, like the attendees, there were a lot of attendees, as I remember, 700 or 800.
Yes.
There were quite a few attendees.
It was like a couple grand. Was it?
I don't remember. I've replaced those memories now with a bunch of crap, and we'll talk about it. I overwrote those because not really important. What I do remember is that it's very, very different from a vendor perspective, like what services grocery? Well, it's a ton of automation, and you see a lot of like robotics and a lot of automated computing. You see a lot of that sort of fulfillment angle, especially around like e-commerce fulfillment and last mile direct delivery partnerships, that sort of thing. And that makes that show interesting for me, right? That's the thing that kind of makes that show interesting.
It is an interesting show. Looking forward to going. Really happy to be here at ETEL. If I recall correctly, for the last grocery shop, that's when we were like, oh, yeah, like Retail X was the sacrificial lamb of conferences. Like they felt like they had sort of come back with grocery shop. Of course, we then went into NRF, which was
NRF was like,
But funnily enough, I feel like, and I think I mentioned this, I was at ETEL West as well. That show was like really the first one back. And then we went into Shop Talk, which was very, 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 very back. And so I feel like, you know, we've kind of got over that shock now. I think it's like, it's just back to business as usual.
Business as usual. Let's speaking of business as usual, let's take a little bit of a side journey here. Recently on the Census, which is a newsletter that comes out twice a week from Future Commerce, we covered a couple things that have just come around recently. A lot of growth in non-alcoholic beverage. And non-alcoholic beverage, while it's growing from all of the, you know, entrenched incumbents, we're also seeing a lot of challenges happening in the NA beverage and low ABV beverage space with a lot of startups, namely House, Helena Hembrecht Price, who is a friend of the show, just put out a Twitter post breaking a long Twitter silence over the last year. But she had posted on Twitter that House was unable to raise its Series A after its lead pulled out. And that sort of put them in a position. She had a great write-up and interview in Bon Appetit that I thought was very enlightening as to the process and like her transparency is like, if I built this business in public, I'm going to sell this business in parts in public too. And I felt like that was really courageous. And then there's been a lot of vitriol that's sort of come out. So there's a few things that have like happened around that I wanted to cover that came out in the Census. The first is something I'm calling, you've heard of the vibe shift.
I have. Actually, I'm really happy we're about to talk about this because I have a lot of thoughts about this that I want to get into. Like, I want to talk about this.
So the vibe shift has happened in a lot of ways, right? It's been recharacterized as well. The vibe shift is, well, the vibes are, people are just kind of going off vibes, right? Like, we're not talking about data anymore. We're talking about vibes. We're talking about quantifiability or scientific, you know, application of business principles. It's just vibes.
Chief vibes officer.
Right. You know. Exactly. We're also, so this sort of like instinctual or gut-based decision-making is a thing that we are hearing, and people are using the word vibe as a surrogate for that. We're also seeing like big swings in cultural behavior, and non-alcoholic beverages are part of that, right? Sobriety movement seems to be part of that, something we've talked about quite a bit. So there's a little bit of that. So that's part of the vibe shift.
Maybe.
And then the Census, well, we also, this week we teased out a shift in thinking around religion and sort of what would be countercultural to, secular and atheistic, adherence. It would be, well, maybe there's, you know, this piece in the New York Times opinion article about, you know, hey, maybe the vibe shift is people returning back to these, organized religions, particularly Catholicism. I think that that's all really interesting, and everyone's put this under the umbrella of vibe shift. So specifically when we're talking about beverage and alcohol, I'm going to call it the imbibe shift. So let's talk about the imbibe shift, and then we'll talk a little bit about the other things, because I find them all sort of wrapped up into, there's a big swing of a lot of opinions are swinging in a lot of different directions away from things that we might have held to be true. So you have a lot to say.
I do have a lot to say. So I heard it said recently that the funniest thing about this idea of vibe shift is that, like, everyone is having a really, really hard time defining what it is and where we're going. And I have a lot of thoughts about this. I think that it actually gets back to the article that I just wrote for Insiders. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, the key to all of this. You can't have a vibe if you're not with somebody. Like, as we've fragmented and things have gotten really, like, one-dimensional in communication method, or even two-dimensional, it's become less dimensional. It is significantly harder to get a vibe or have a vibe. And so the big joke of the vibe shift is that it's like no one can really figure out what's going on. I think that that's because we just haven't really had the opportunity to be together. Like, reforming culture is what has to happen, and it hasn't. Like, we were separated so significantly, and we continue to be separated more than we have in the past. Hmm. And you can't get a vibe on someone without being next to them. Like, literally, like, smell, feel, touch, you know, it's like,
you have to smell a person to really get the vibe. That's what you're saying.
I mean, I think that's not that far off, actually.
Just double down on it. Yeah.
I'm doubling down on it. I think the hardest thing is getting a good read on someone. You can't get a good read on somebody or a situation unless you're all together. So
what if let's tease that out for a second. So when people say the vibes are bad in Web 3, right? Or the vibe shift that happened in Web 3, these aren't people that are all acting independently in silos with each other. They're doing that, but they're not next to somebody. These are digital communities. So how does the vibe shift then happen? So what you're describing sounds like
general cultural, right. So you're talking about specific communities. I think
I have a theory. I'm trying to get to your thing before I disagree with you. I want to understand yours deeper.
Yeah, because I think, well, there's this, like when the Vibe Shift article came out, mm-hmm. which was immediately read by everyone and immediately criticized by everyone. I think the point of the article was like, hey, like, we've gone through these different vibes, which I think everyone was like actually on, like, that part wasn't criticized. Identification of vibe was not criticized. It's the outcome. Like, the outcome was, well, things are changing again, and like, maybe it's indie sleaze. Like, the projection of where we were headed was like, okay, you say vibe shift. Well, there's nothing to put a finger on as to what it is. And so I think my point is that, like, that's because as a general culture, we've been more fragmented and disconnected and single modality with our communication, or I shouldn't say a single modality, but we've been separated by screens. And we've been asynchronous in a lot of communication more than we ever have.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Bolt. Bolt has a seamless and simple one-click checkout that can boost your e-commerce conversion rate by up to 47%. But how does that work? Well, it's really simple. It turns your guest shoppers into logged-in customers, and it lets your customers breeze through checkout and enjoy an effortless and secure experience across any other Bolt-powered website. What does that mean? It means merchants are more likely to see an increase in sales and conversions. It's easy to see that Bolt's one-click checkout is a win-win for everybody, for the customer and for the merchant. Learn more today by visiting bolt.com/futurecommerce. That's bolt.com/futurecommerce. That makes more sense, is that everybody's sort of casting lots of their vibes into, you know, a communal pool. And in that behavior, some of the contribution of those vibes aren't they're not happening simultaneously. So you sort of create this like almost like layer cake effect of you're just building on what the last vibe was, where as opposed to, and I like, so let's talk about commerce for a second, because this is where I think, this is where I think that the shift specifically, forget the vibe for a second, but the shift
Yes.
If the vibes are bad, you go find where the vibes are good. And this is where, like, do you want to wallow in pity and wallow in sadness and, or whatever, like, defeatism that you're feeling, whatever, you know, whatever you happen to be going through. Culturally, if you can change your circumstance and go be around people who aren't, you know, in the pit of despair, wouldn't you go do that? And that could be for me, you know, maybe if for years, you know, maybe the folks you're hanging around, you change the people you're hanging around and that changes the mood. And maybe those people don't drink as much anymore, right? Maybe they do things in the morning. They don't hang out late at night. And maybe that's what causes you to kind of rethink your priorities when it comes to alcohol consumption. And that changes what you buy. And that changes the kind of brands that need to belong in the world. And maybe, and this is a, you know, a bit of a stretch, but, you know, Kyle Chayka wrote this piece for New Yorker magazine. And he says, well, algorithm anxiety, which is a phrase that I like to think that I coined in October of 2021, when I wrote a piece called The Idolatry of the Algorithm. I talked about algorithm anxiety and how algorithms are controlling every part of our lives and everything around us. Maybe a digital fast and unplugging from the matrix is what you need so that the vibes are different, so that you're not like you turn off Instagram when it makes you feel bad, right? And you turn off Twitter when people are being vitriolic. And maybe you just delete your LinkedIn because the CEOs are crying and they're performatively being vulnerable in front of the whole world. But when you make space in your life to do that, you're going to put your time somewhere else. Where does that time go? The time goes to something else that must exist in the world to fill that space and occupy it. That results in different purchasing decisions and different people groups that you wind up aligning to. And so, you know, take that back to algorithm anxiety. If algorithms are controlling everything in your life and you want to unplug from that, maybe there are religious communities or spiritual communities, and maybe you're not monotheistic, but maybe we're more, you know, polytheistic nowadays. Like, we believe a little bit more of everything. Take a little from this, take a little from that. Like, we're a little more spiritually open-minded. We did this study for Visions. 41% of people said they're more superstitious now than they used to be 2 years ago. You know, people are a little more open to, you know, exploring more areas of their spirituality. They're finding more people to do that with. That changes the way you behave. It changes the things you buy, the clothes you wear to if you go to a church, it changes because the people group that you're aligning to changes. And so that's the thing that I'm trying to get to, is that, like, yeah, you like, the unplugging itself changes a lot of the behavior.
I think you're absolutely dead on. I'm going to keep coming back to this, probably will be for like the next like 10 years of my life. But I am being heavily influenced by Marshall McLuhan right now.
For those unaffiliated and not me, because I'm definitely all the way up to speed, but who's
Marshall McLuhan was an advertiser, philosopher, inventor, professor, a thinker from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, of course.
he wrote a bunch of books. The one that's like really visually impacting me right now is a book called The Medium is the Message. You heard that right, Message. He actually came up with The Medium is the Message, which was in a prior book that he wrote, but this one was sort of dedicated to sort of rehashing a set of ideas he'd written about in previous books, but he did it in a really like visually like compelling. And actually, I'll say this, Philip, but we haven't even talked about this much yet, but we are like unintentional, like disciples of McLuhan in many ways. Like, his visual styles and the way that he like puts stuff together in this book, like even down to the eye on the cover, which, yeah, just blowing my mind that like what he was able to like almost practically like prophesy, which is incredible at understanding implications for the electronic world. And one of the things that
In a pre-digital society.
In a pre-digital society. This is in the 60s.
He wrote an advertising guru. Like he understood influence and he understood, you know, shaping desires. That's like.
Correct. Right. Well, and for him, like his whole idea that the medium is the message is that like the media, the form of media is actually an extension of us and actually reflects back on us. And the content of that media isn't as powerful as the media itself and what it does to us, how it's built and how it affects us.
Is so unbelievably true. And this is so unbelievably true. And people will argue and say it's not true, but there is a bookish person or someone who's like a voracious reader has a bit of a stereotype. Like yes. You can kind of conjure up what they yes. might look like. You might think to yourself, that is what a bookish person looks like, right? A Twitter bro or a LinkedIn CEO also has a bit of a, you can conjure up what that person, how they might behave, the kinds of things that they may frequent, the kinds of, you know,
yes.
the kinds of brands they may buy. You're absolutely, the medium really is the message. Like it is, and the person, you know, tends to that either the media shapes them or the media attracts a certain sort of a
yes
it's both, they're sympathetic.
So back to vibe shift, something that he says in this book is he talks about being in a world of all at onceness, which is the idea that everything is simultaneously happening as a result of electronic communication and connection. And so all the vibes are all happening at one time because it's all like moving back and forth. And, you know, he said literally this is a quote, information pours upon us instantaneously and continuously. As soon as information is acquired, is very rapidly replaced by still newer information. Our electronically configured world has forced us to move from the habit of data classification to the mode of pattern recognition. We can no longer build serial block by block, step by step, because instant communication ensures that all factors of the environment and of experience coexist in a state of active interplay. This is in the 60s. This guy
was not on Twitter. Man, I wonder what he would think about Twitter today. That's it's brilliant. Also, this comes back to something that we talked about in our former podcast, the one right before this, yes. our interview with Shay Taylor about yes. there's nothing new under the sun. Like the things that we continue to invent are just new and rehashed. They're not even new. They're sort of rehashed ideas, rediscovered ideas, re-implemented modalities and forms of communication or commerce that already exist somewhere and have already existed and will exist again in the future. And we all think that we're also smart and novel, and that we're all doing something, you know, truly unique. In reality, we're, you know, something that I had said in the Visions podcast recently is Mike Lachman, the CEO of Trade Coffee, said, well, we must stand on the shoulders of giants. And I said, well, or you could, you know, tread on the casualties of war. Like they are effectively the same thing, right? And I feel like we're, in some respects, we're certainly standing on others' accomplishments, and on others, we're, you know, treading on some graves.
To back to the senses, there was an article in the Sense that is just recently about, by Derek Thompson in The Atlantic, about how like everything's getting older. And one of the reasons he gave for that is that there is so much that has come before us and there is so much information available to us that in order for us to actually do anything of significance, we actually have to absorb so much more before we get there. I think that's really interesting. But you also contrast that with the idea from McLuhan again of like the amateur versus the professional, and how amateurs have actually been the ones to shape the world,
right?
Because professionals have to Like they have to play into their profession. Amateurs can go explore. Michael Faraday never really took any formal like math aside from elementary education and reinvented our complete understanding of electricity. It's only those who have nothing to lose and that do not have to play to a community that can step outside of it.
There's reminds me of a film from the early 2000s, starring Nicolas Cage, one of the greatest actors of our generation.
I'm in.
There's a film called Adaptation.
Love that movie.
Where Nick Cage plays a writer, and as he's writing, the things that he's writing come into being, right? They become made manifest reality. And in my recollection, this is like both for like good and for bad, right? Like there's calamity, there's hilarity. Looking back on some of the things that we've talked about or we've written over the last few years in the the pages of Future Commerce or in some of our research, like the Visions Report, I feel like some of the things that we're talking about have come to pass a lot quicker than I thought it would. In fact, in this piece about algorithm anxiety, Kyle Chayka, calls back some of the things that we've been talking about the way that there's like sort of the same sort of psycho-spiritual stressors that people that are like being deprogrammed from cults experience. This like weight of oversight or a weight of surveillance that sort of hangs over them and their inability to make decisions for themselves is the same kind of weight that people that suffer from extreme dependence on algorithms may be experiencing. And it's a new classification of, behavioral and personality disorders. And in some ways, I start thinking to myself, like, is there a possibility that we are exploring these things that exist in the world and we're putting language to them? Like, as we've said before, that's like kind of our job, but nobody really understands that. Like we try to pattern match, we try to recognize trends, and then we try to name those things so that they're easier to identify. Mm-hmm. Or are we somehow manifesting them? Because that's
good question.
It's a really good question that there's a lot of the early work in science fiction was incredibly like utopic realities. The fact is that the last 50 years of science fiction has been very dystopic, and the writing you have what you say, and then you say what you have. This like self-reinforcement cycle that we happen to be in is like we're all building towards a future that maybe is not so bright because we have been, I don't know, we've been immersed in it our whole lives, and popular culture is like, this is the eventuality, right? It's.
I do wonder if that's because I think that the ultimate end of utopian thinking is dystopic reality. Utopian
thinking, the lack of free will, the lack of choice, even if things look sparkly and shiny and new in reality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Enforced systems always lead to problems. Like they always lead to much worse consequences than the ultimate good that they were hoping to attain, because humanity is not fitting well into a box.
can we get back to non-alcoholic beverages? Somehow, like, to me, this seems like really indicative of a bunch of things where people are realizing that, and I don't want to like make you have to preach my points here, because I know that you and I have definitely different consumption habits, but I used to drink alcohol 5 years ago. Stopped drinking alcohol. I feel like I'm better for it. I feel like a lot of people in that intervening 5 years have also decided that drinking alcohol, whether their Whoop band told them that that was bad and so they realized it was bad, or whether they just realized one day, I feel better when I don't drink. So, or maybe they're on medication, whatever the reason might be. Seems like a lot more people are making that sort of decision now. And that's part of I think it's like a crucial part of the vibe shift, is that there's two things happening at once. Not only are people making personal health decisions and putting that out into the world, but people are being influenced by it, but it's creating this uncorking effect where the more people feel like they've been given permission to be able to share that sort of personal information, the more it's taking hold and giving other people permission to also try it and be part of that lifestyle for themselves, right? It's causing more people, I think, to really question and examine, do I have a dependency on alcohol that I'm not comfortable with? Is this a change that I need to make that I wasn't considering making before? That is a massive vibe shift. And one that I think hasn't really existed in a prevalent way in our culture before. Thank you to our sponsor, Divvy, the corporate card and expense management platform. Transform your complicated, exhausting, stressful, and manual expense management to being simple, automated, quick, and, dare I say, almost too easy. You can do that with Divvy. Try it for free today at getdivvy.com/futurecommerce. That's getdivvy, DIVVY.com/futurecommerce. This podcast is brought to you by 3Kit. Today's discerning brands are looking for ways to gain share by bringing innovative, configurable products to market. And that's easier said than done. But the good news is, there's 3Kit. From visualizing products in beautiful 3D and augmented reality, to integrating with your existing tech stack and representing 100% of your product catalog, 3Kit can scale an entire visual product experience for your brand. And this means that you can deliver engaging, immersive experiences that make shoppers happy to click the buy button. It's simple. When you show more, you sell more. So get started on your visual commerce journey today at 3kit.com/podcast. That's 3 spelled out, T-H-R-E-E, kit.com/podcast.
Moving past like imbibe or not imbibe, like, do you think that is true for a lot of things, like where someone might feel a certain way or, you know, or want to like, or like they're just being more, you know, quote unquote transparent about things that they have going on? What do you think the net effect of that is across all areas, like not just alcohol, but like everything, like
the, well, let's yeah. take the small things, right? Because I mean, alcohol consumption could be certainly a very divisive, you know, topic. 2 years ago, it was extremely fashionable, especially if you were in venture capital, to quote Yuval Noah Harari's book *Sapiens*. Right, having it on your bookshelf, saying that you're reading it, taking a picture of you with the book. It's extremely fashionable. Everybody's like, you got to read this
LinkedIn
book.
LinkedIn
loved this book. Twitter loved this book. 2 years later, it is extremely unfashionable to like this book, right? You see things now, it's like he's a 10, but he reads Sapiens, right?
Right.
And I find that these sorts of elements of fashion, they sort of rise and fall extremely quickly based on who it was that gave permission in the marketplace to have that point of view. Like, I don't think that people changed their minds on where they stand on the book in that intervening time. I think that certain crowds of people were given permission to speak their minds based on who it was that spoke up first. That is what I think is a massive, this like, so that is fashion. That's so, fashion, right? Like it's fashionable to hate something. So the people that hate it speak up, and it's fashionable to like something. So the people that like it speak up.
Do you think that there's something even bigger though, that we have to contend with like smaller trends? Like, I'm going to go back to McLuhan again. He has a section in the message.
The next 10 years are going to be great with you, by the way. Posthumously, he's only written so many books. So I hope we move through them quickly.
That's why I said 10 years. This section is called The Others. He says, the shock of recognition in electronic information environment, minority groups can no longer be contained or ignored. Too many people know too much about each other. Our new environment compels commitment and participation. We have become irrevocably involved with and responsible for each other.
So let's contextualize that in his time, which was 1960s, you said?
Yeah, this is like 67, I think. This
oh, yeah. Oh, so I mean, like he's in the middle of civil rights movement in the United States. Massive upheaval, a lot of civil unrest. And yes. Minority groups in particular can mean a lot of things. Like it can mean everything from underprivileged and oppressed minority groups, like as people groups. And you can that could be sexual orientation. It could be racial definition. But it could also be minority group affiliations like the KKK coming into light for the first time. Like we're shining a light on the dark.
All of it.
It's, like, he's talking about,
all of it. He's saying that every minority group must be contended with because we are all connected to the information at all times. And so like that's kind of what I think that actually plays like into exactly what you're saying.
The minority groups are becoming even more minority now, though. And this goes to a really interesting I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast of Balaji Srinivasan just wrote a book. Not on audiobook yet, but you can get it for free, called The Network State. I believe you can get it for free, the PDF for free at thenetworkstate.com. And there's also a free Kindle version. But his, you know, his big idea here is that the nation state is, you know, a physical manifestation of something. The network state is the digital neighborhoods organizing into like legitimized people groups that have, you know, that have citizenship. And the bigger idea there is really Bitcoin maxis are the fundamentalists, and they're the ones who most embody the network state because they are aligned around ideology, right? And they are aligned around an implementation of something like an idea and an ideal.
Back to utopianism,
which goes back to this idea of political affiliation, right? It's also like a policy decision too. Is like how do we maximize the proliferation of our ideas through policy is another hallmark of a network state. Certainly, I'm not going to try to recount all of that here. What's really interesting about what you're saying is that is playing out now, even though it was foretold in the 60s, the minority groups are becoming even more minority over time.
Right.
And that there's like niche groups that are gaining
the Sapiens
incredible
readers.
Yes. It's the Sapiens.
that's a minority group.
That is the otherification that he was talking about the others. He never even watched Lost. He saved so much of his time. Never had to watch Lost. Hundreds of hours I put into Lost. All for naught.
You're not in the minority there.
let's bring this back around. I do want to tease out this idea. So there was that story that I said that we would get to. There was the story about Braden Wallachie, who posted on LinkedIn a picture of him crying because he laid off some folks from Hypersocial. Very divisive post. We'll link it up here in the show notes, just so we're all aware. I think this is terribly cringy.
I'm not sure it was very divisive, actually.
Most everybody hates it. Yeah,
very united. It was a very united response.
People hate this, and as well they should. It's very cringy. My take on this, Brian, was how do you get here? How does he do this?
Right.
Right. And let me.
Right.
Let me.
No,
let me.
I love. Actually, I love your take. People were happy to jump in and like
criticize.
I love this take, actually.
Let's take this context and change it, right? Like if this were a Zoom recording of him delivering the message that he had to let his staff go and he was crying, that would have been no problem, right? The real cringe factor is that he has taken a picture, ostensibly has taken a picture of himself or multiple and had to choose one. Like he had took a picture of himself crying as a selfie and attached it to a LinkedIn style narrative of look how sad this whole thing is. And I'm building in public. And this is, so you're right. It's not divisive at all. I think everybody unanimously or has decided that this is, bad behavior and cringeworthy. What I'm trying to get at is what made him do this,
Right. Right. Because a lot of people just think, oh, what a
douche. Idiot. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. How could he think this was a good idea? Right. Is this bad judgment? Right. Is he trying to capitalize and like get fake internet points from other people suffering? I mean, yes, on both accounts, I guess, to some degree. But what makes him do it? Why would he make the decision to post this? And I think that what I've come down to is the algorithm taught him that this is what the bloodthirsty, you know, Colosseum crowd with gladiators in arena demand of us now. Right. Yes.
In fact, he might have even been rewarded for his efforts in some ways.
I've never heard of hypersocial. Received. I've never seen no one at Vice has ever written about this guy, probably. Right.
Right.
Like, yeah. So my take here is what role, like, yes, he has agency. Yes, he is a human capable of making decisions.
Right.
He has to own his own bad behavior.
Right.
Like, but how do you become the kind of a person who would take a picture of yourself crying and post it on LinkedIn of all platforms? The algorithm. At the end of the day, it comes down to this is the kind of thing that gets reach in our world. And the algorithm doesn't care if that's because it's cringy. The algorithm doesn't care if that's because it's earnest or it's authentic. The algorithm is optimized for reach.
Yes.
And so if you are becoming one with the algorithm, like, and you're very online and you're like him, you are learning over time innate, like through behavior.
Performative content.
It's performative public vulnerability.
Right.
He's being rewarded for it. Right. Yes. Is that his fault? Like, this is, is it his fault that he's, this is the world we've created.
Right. So you said it earlier. People are responsible for their decisions. Like this, there's a lot of people out there that will, for the purposes of growing their business or getting attention or whatever it is, they are going to follow the algorithm because they have decided that is who they are. Like, this particular outcome is just one in a long string of like decisions to post in a style that is going to be rewarded by the system.
I mean, the reward being attention, right?
Attention. Yes. Correct. Yep.
But reach. Let's take this like one step further, because I really think that this is really critical. In Visions, we talked about a topic. One of our trends was the celebration of insincerity, right?
Yes.
And I don't know what to call this.
But what if this is the algorithm's celebration of insincerity?
I mean, this is as close to, if we believe that an algorithm can shape our desires and tastes, which I believe most people would agree. In fact, in our Visions study this year, I think it was 54%. I'd have to call back the actual numbers. I'm not going to pull it up here, but 54% or so of survey respondents in our study said that they believe that algorithms or social media suggestions and trends shape their tastes, right?
Yes.
Shapes the way that they buy things. If that is the case, then why wouldn't that also naturally shape the kind of posts that you create? And over time, eventually, evolutionarily, you get some weird aberration of an evolution where it's like, we're going to have some weird outcomes from that, where there's going to be outliers. And one of those outliers is the kind of person who would publish a post of him crying, you know, on LinkedIn that's incredibly cringeworthy. That becomes a nature versus nurture conversation. Right. And I don't know that anybody would publicly say that they believe that someone is a racist by nature. Like, I think a lot of people would say, well, you learn that, right? You learn that from a young age, or you're raised in an environment to behave that way. Or like, maybe it's the media diet that you consume that like changes people over time. Something we had in the census this week was irony poisoning, right? The alt-right pipeline is driven by people who are just like super on 4chan, and like they're just ironists, and they're so wrapped up in irony, eventually it becomes truth to them. And yeah, is this someone's nature to post like this, or do they learn that and acquire that over time?
Channel right now again. I won't quote him again, but like, yeah, he gets into how humor is like going to be the dominant form of communication.
Yeah, but that's kind of where we are at the moment, anyway.
Yes, I do think you're on to something interesting here as well. I wrote for the census while you were out, and I did quote McLuhan, so that if the media is the message and AI is the ultimate media, if the algorithm is the ultimate media, the message is humanity is unnecessary. the reason I wrote that is because I think AI is taking over, the algorithm is sort of taking over things that humanity can analyze. What is, what could be, and what should be. We can see this clearly. Like, AI is very good in analyzing previous data, right? It's good at like saying, oh, these are the things that were, and then projecting what could happen if those things continued. And it's not perfect. It's getting better, but it's getting better and better and better. But also now we're applying it towards what should be, right? And I think that's where, like, when we let an algorithm define what should exist, we've actually handed over our job as humans.
Well, let's be real for a moment. This person is the head of an organization that I'm guessing by the name alone, Hypersocial, has something to do with social
media. It's built for the algo.
It's built for the algorithm. And if they're into lead generation and content marketing, right? Hypersocial and their medium is social media. It stands to reason that, you know, this person, you know, he's a person, right? He's a human being. This person's livelihood depends and is at the mercy of the algorithm. Right. So as a commercial actor, as a person in a play on a stage, the script writer, he's at the mercy of the script writer. Script writer is the algorithm. His whole business is at the mercy of the whims and changes of a technology company and the way that they tune and game, right? Or buff or nerf things that become, you know, viable content that will get organic reach. Mm-hmm. He's learned this. In fact, he's learned it so well that he's the main character on Twitter today, which is like, you should never be the main character on Twitter.
But maybe that's the main outcome. Like, if you follow that to its illogical conclusion, like he did it. He followed it. He followed it to its like ultimate end.
It is the ultimate success. This is probably the most successful post he'll ever make of all time. Yes. He did exactly what he was supposed to do.
Again, this gets back to like what you should do.
Is this nature or nurture? He's not uniquely qualified to have the organic reach that he has. He did what the algorithm expected of him to do, or has given him the parameters to behave within.
If we hand over what
I'm realizing this is a bad take, but I feel like we have to talk about it. Like, we have to get this out there. It's like, I'm not trying to absolve him of behavior.
Right.
But it's not good behavior.
If we hand over what we should do to an algorithm, this is the outcome. This is the outcome. Like, we can't, like, this is where I think we need to like say that if the future is going to be a human story, like this is actually sort of one of those like landmark moments where it's like, and I hate to put it that way, but like, this is what happens if we put things into the control of a computer.
Sure.
And we say, oh, like, this is the outcome that we are looking for. Like, we are going to end up all performatively crying on Twitter. Like,
but people have been performatively crying on TikTok for 2 years. Yeah. This is the this is the thing that I cannot get over, is that this same manifestation in other social media social media channels is also performative and is used in an ironic sense. Yes. This guy actually did it in, I would say, like, attempted to be authentic and he was attempting.
But it's insincere. That's why it's so cringy. Like,
it's insincere because it's just not a thing that is socially acceptable to be posting online. Like,
No, that's not why it's insincere. It's because the dude took like 20 photos. Like, he's got his,
We don't know that. He posted one photo.
Okay. Okay.
Let's be real. You know, there are plenty of posts on TikTok of people crying into a camera. Yes. That happens all the time. It's a trend. Like, that's what people do. Right. And so to tell him that, to say that, like, what I don't want to do is say that he should blame his behavior and, like, excuse his behavior because the algorithm made him do it. But in reality, the algorithm did. Like, that is true.
If you believe, as he did, that the ultimate aim is to please the algorithm and to, like, get the most reach, then you're absolutely right.
I don't think he would have said it that way.
No, that's what I'm saying.
The ultimate aim is I have an audience.
Yes.
They expect me to build transparently.
Yes.
I'm building in public.
Yes.
I have put everything in public.
Right.
So this is in public too.
Right.
What is the best way to show that I emotionally care? Like, this is the decision matrix that you go through.
Right.
To wind up here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We are incredibly aligned. I need you to be yelling at me and telling me I'm wrong. But I feel like this is what we haven't realized yet, is exactly how much, like, we'll point out things like this and say LinkedIn is so choogy, but that's not LinkedIn. It's every algorithm. We're all doing this all of the time. It's the societal norms around when we say something's out of bounds, is it's taking us by surprise, because we haven't really figured out yet that the behaviors are unbelievably malleable, and we're very, very, very susceptible to being guided into certain behaviors. And those behaviors, we can't even visualize what they look like, because they're a bunch of if-then statements that are in GitHub somewhere. And and it's not regulated. And we're going to see a whole lot more of this. And in fact,
I think that's absolutely correct.
Yes.
You've nailed it. We've already seen a lot of it. This one caught us off guard because it's such an outlier.
It pushes the boundaries so much.
Well, it's not such an outlier. It's just enough of an outlier to, like, be like, for us to step back and be like, hold up here. Like, this is where we're headed.
We're all going to be posting our
tearful videos.
We all will. I'm tearfully going to post this because I'm exhausted by the conversation already. Let me say one last thing. If I had to make a prediction, Google used to name its algorithm updates, right? They'd give it a name, right? And when they were going to rev it and roll it out, because they always were big friction points for the community. And they also, back in those days, required big, like, code level changes for Google and its search rankings, right? And it was, like, really disruptive for a lot of businesses.
Yeah.
So they would give it a name. And in fact, this kind of thing happens all the time in gaming. I played League of Legends for a little while, and they had seasons. And when a season came and went, and there were buffs and nerfs for some of your favorite, forget what we called them, champions. And so it's like, certain things got introduced, certain things got taken away, some things were overpowered, some things, right? Twitter has had the same algorithm for the last year, maybe longer. It's like threads have just been over indexed. They're way too powerful, right? The thread champ, way too powerful. And it can clobber anyone's timeline, because all you have to do is put a thread together. It doesn't even have to be good. If it follows a certain format, it becomes a meme instantly. Everybody gets internet points from it. What I think is going to happen is we're going to see a lot more of the sort of seasonal variety of changing of the algorithm, and a lot more public discourse around, from organizations who are realizing that behavior is being curbed or being encouraged by the way the algorithms are being shaped. So rather than Twitter telling us that they're going to encourage certain types of behavior, we're going to see them saying, hey, for the next year, we're deprioritizing threads. For the next year, we're deprioritizing, you know, certain types of just like the way they can recognize hate speech, just the way that they can recognize, you know, video where there's self-harm. In all those same ways, we're going to have to see an era in the next few years where social media businesses, especially video entertainment businesses like TikTok, are much more transparent of when big algorithm changes are going to impact people so that their behaviors align accordingly. And it's going to have to happen, because if they don't, regulation's going to have to step in.
I think you're onto something really interesting here, which is this is what happens. Like the crying selfie is what happens when you don't update the algorithm soon enough.
Yes.
Like if you're not updating it frequently enough, eventually it will lead to undesirable outcomes, because everyone, like you, the game will get played too well. Yeah.
Evolutionary exaggeration. Like he's over-optimized for a certain type of behavior that, you know, winds us up here. Threads are another good example. Like Twitter has become more like LinkedIn every day because that's what the algorithm.
Totally. And actually, back to your point about Google, I think like the types of behaviors that we saw back then were super cringy as well. The gray hat and black hat SEO patterns were worse. They were downright illegal, and really bad for the internet as far as like content went. It was like we all tried to optimize. We had to. If you wanted to get recognized as a website, you had to. And this is like, I think what we're seeing here with some of these social platforms is underdeveloped algorithms or unattended to algorithms.
Unattended. I would say it's unattended. Like by now, if they were a video game company, there would have been 20 revs. Like there would have been multiple changes to try to curb certain types of behavior, because at the end of the day,
it's all gamification.
It's all being game. Like nobody wants to behave. Anyway, let's come back to the vibe shift. I think a lot of the vibe shift has to do with unattended algorithms and the, like, exaggerated evolutionary like behaviors that are happening online, in primarily in text communication like Twitter and LinkedIn, and in video communication like TikTok and Instagram. Like those.
I'm going to go a step further. I think that those vibes are all false. That's why we see them fall away so fast, and that's why they change when the algorithm changes. If we want to see anything of lasting, like a lasting cultural change,
it happens offline. Yeah,
yes.
It happens
offline. If you want to see a vibe shift, go unplug.
That's a great place to leave it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Future Commerce. You can find more episodes of this podcast and all Future Commerce properties, including but not limited to our Visions podcast, which is getting rave reviews. It's sort of the intersection of culture, philosophy, and spirituality with commerce over top of all of it. It's an amazing series. Really, really proud of the work that we've done there. We also have Decoded. We have Step by Step, lots to clue into, and the once and foretold return of Infinite Shelf. So lots of podcast content coming. You get all at futurecommerce.fm. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter, The Senses. You can get that at futurecommerce.fm/subscribe. Thank you for listening. Commerce is a catalyst for change in whose world? Your world, the world around you. And we really believe that. And maybe if we all did it, could change the world. Thank you so much for listening.